a caveat. This is working notes. Unsynthesized CIA notes, FOIA requests are just coming in. I'm trying to deal with archival stuff, so it's all in the process. So please push back. Help me figure it out before it's too late. This is what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you in one word why it failed, or why the Soviet internet failed. Well, the one word is decentralization. I'm going to tell you a couple other things. First, I'm going to tell you why you should be surprised that the Soviet internet failed, what I mean by that. And I'm going to then talk about what may or may not have happened, what decentralization, what I mean by it, how the Soviet Union itself was or was not decentralized, how its networks attempts in the 50s and 60s were decentralized, and then problems of power sharing and the implicit in those in that design. But I want to point out that there's probably one person in the English-speaking world who knows this stuff, and it's not me, it's Slava Gorovich, who is present here today. So if you have any follow-up questions on the history, we have the real person here. Slava, and I think rightly so, has written some wonderful stuff on Soviet cybernetics and the history of nationwide networks there. And I generally am a big fan also of cyber history, I might call it, or something, where we try to look at the present movement or digital communications today through a historical perspective. I think if there's anything Berkman needs, it's more historians of science and technology. So,
but you like living in New York.
I like
living in New York.
I'm not complaining. Berkman is everywhere. So why we should be surprised? Where are we? Okay. The Soviet Union actually had a lot going for it at the same time that the ARPANET was being developed in the U.S. and sort of 59 to 69 is when it was established. But in that early formative period, it had the intelligence it needed, it had the intellectuals it needed, it had the funding, and interestingly, it also had the social interest that would be necessary to develop a nationwide computer network for non-military purposes. That's going to be the focus of what I'm talking about. So we, you know, there were spies. Spies were on both sides, and CIA documents show that they were concerned about a unified information net being developed by the Soviets as early as possibly, like, Sovel, correct me, but as early as 57. In terms of intellectuals, the Soviet tradition is rich with mathematics and theoretical brilliance. Some of the cutting-edge theoretical programming in the 50s and 60s is still more advanced than what we've come up with today. Never mind, they were often writing on blackboards. Now, so, I mean, there's a gap. There's a hardware gap, certainly, but they definitely had the intellectual capital to pull this off. And interestingly, unlike America to some degree, is this larger societal interest in computers and networks at the time. Of course, there was present in the U.S., but cybernetics in particular swept and was sweeping the Soviet Union in 55 to 65 and later. With cybernetics came a vast interest in what computers could do. Let me stress, in fact, that cybernetics, if you don't know what that is, you're in good company. Is essentially a science of making analogies precise. It's a way of thinking through the analogies between engineering networks and nervous systems, the computer and the mind, servo mechanisms, so these are machines that use negative feedback to correct themselves, and purposeful human behavior, machines and animals. It was a very expansive thing, but the Soviets adopted that, put the computer as its driving tool, and really thought through most of their sciences. It was a reformist-oriented approach to science. And it had computers at the heart of it. This culture, I believe, the culture of analogy making, helps us backlight the other administrative and political reasons I'm going to look at for the decentralization of Soviet computers. But let me begin with the answer, why did it fail? Let me tell you what the historian of the institute that was charged, the institute is called the Central Economic and Mathematical Institute, and it was charged with building a network that could manage the whole socialist economy. That was sort of the founding vision. It was going to build a computer network that would process all this information and manage program, not even plan, but program the socialist economy. He says, why did it fail? Because of the romanticism of its globality, he writes. And this is the only sentence on it. He said it was, from the beginning, it was doomed to failure. Mind, he's writing 20 years later. He continues, it was decided to plan the country's unified information network hierarchically, he writes, just as the economy was planned in those days. And the explanation ends there. Why the hierarchical structure? There's nothing more than an analogy with the present economy and of the Soviets, of the Soviet Union in the 60s. So what went wrong? I'm going to touch upon two things: power hoarding of funding and of information data within ministries themselves, within the ministries that would have made this network possible. And I'm going to try to, those two I frame that both the power hoarding and the information, the reluctance to share information and funding can be understood in under a larger framework of the Soviet Union as a decentralized agency. And why decentralization? Why is that important? Let me jump to this. In 1964, Paul Baran, a key architect of the ARPANET, publishes his paper on distributed communication that, as many of you may know, launches the first wave of packet switching work. And he makes three distinctions. There are three ideal types of networks: centralized, decentralized, and his new contribution, well, not really his, but distributed networks. The comprehensive design, can I stand? This is okay. So what we have here basically are two ideal types connected through by a continuum. You can see here that, you can describe in one move how to form each of these. You know, the one rule you need to create a centralized network is simply connect all points to one master node. The one rule you need to create a distributed network is also simple: connect any node to any neighboring nodes, right? And if those rules, sort of algorithmic, if they're algorithms, can be run to the extreme, you will come up with an ideal type of either purely centralized or purely distributed network. And everything, technically speaking, other than that, falls in between. Centralized systems links make control possible, whereas in distributed system links make communication possible. And I think we like to believe today that the ARPANET, and subsequently the internet, was distributed in design. There's reason to believe this. That classic trope of TCP/IP protocol, or the end-to-end principle, seems it worth repeating here. That network nodes of intelligence, the moments of intelligence or control, should ideally appear only at the ends of transmission, that is, between the sender and the receiver terminals, and not in between. And this was key for building the packet switching protocol. So what's curious here is that the decentralized network is an important mixture of these two, and it cannot necessarily be described simply. It has no single ideal type. There's no consistency or an internal pattern necessarily. They can have hierarchy or layers, pyramid shapes, or implied centers, sometimes multiple centers. Decentralized networks can have well-ordered layers of decentralized control, or they can be sort of randomly assigned links between nodes. In either case, most of what we deal with in everyday life is in some way or not a decentralized network. So what does this all matter? Well, basically, if you want to design a decentralized network, if you set out to design a decentralized network, that requires an extra layer of architectural vision. You can design a distributed network locally. You can describe any moment on this network locally. You can just say this, connect to all others. This as well, in a sense, although it's a comprehensive master plan. You say connect everything to Moscow. Instead, if you're intentionally planning to design a decentralized network, I suggest you face added sort of architectural burden. Now, why might have somebody chosen to to intentionally design a decentralized network? Now, I'm not sure, but let me point out that it may have been the rage at the time that, in fact, the Soviet Union can be usefully understood as a decentralized entity. So in many discussions of critiquing the Soviet Union, Western critics say it's all about centralized power. You know, here, let me actually not give you that quite yet. I'm in control, right? My error. And we sort of think that the Soviet Union can be described as a torturous history of trying to centralize everything, and in a sense that's true. But I believe that the Soviet experience, unlike many others today, should begin with analysis of the decentralized nature of projects, political, technical, social, and otherwise. Even the name, Sovietsky Soyuz, you know, makes this point. Soyuz is a union, and Soviet is a council. So it's a union of separated councils. While not wanting to be geographically essentialist, there's also the point that so the Soviet Union couldn't help but to be decentralized. It is 11 time zones big. It has points west of where Kant grew up and points east of Micronesia. How would you describe the Soviet Union? You could say it's north, but that sort of belittles its single claim to, there's no other nation that claims sovereignty over territory in Antarctica. So in that sense, you know, Russian sovereignty is actually the furthest most southern point in the world too. It sort of avoids or evades north, south, east, west and distinctions. It's simply big. And add 14 republics, and it becomes clear that the Soviet Union cannot only be Moscow. It is also true, by the way, that you can apparently see Russia from Alaska. But it might also be worth pointing out that Moscow is actually farther away from Anchorage than Oslo, Shanghai, Washington, D.C., and the Aurora Borealis. So there's, you know, no clear proximity, but never mind. It's a big place. There are also, you know, socially and structurally, there's, let's just look at a couple, how the Soviet Union was designed. You can understand that there was it's kind of hard to see, but there's a centralization of administrative zones here. You can see how it sort of tapers out and gets larger. It's obviously multiple layers of power. Here's the electricity network. If somebody wants to show me how to use GIS software and sort of network analyze this stuff, this could be immensely useful. You can get some good quantitative data out of this. But, you know, look, just get a sense of what's going on. This is a concentrated but not purely concentrated. There's important peripheries, and, you know, a lot of the power is harvested from afar and brought in. This is almost impossible to see. But here are the road networks in red. Clearly, not all roads run to Moscow. So in essence, I argue that I've written elsewhere on Estonia and Ukraine, but I believe that the Soviet Union needs to be understood through the lens of its stubborn peripheries. There's a lot of ingenuity and innovation being created at the edges, and often scholars were sort of given a test run out in the peripheries and in the boondocks in Siberia, and then brought into Moscow if they were deemed appropriate or worth state support. Let's look at some of the network attempts then. There were between the early or the mid 1950s and late 1960s at least four attempts to build computer networks in the Soviet Union. One of them I'm going to talk about, that was the economic network. But three other ones were military. I skipped a very important one. Communist Party. The way it was structured is also clearly pyramidic. I mean, you can't really see this. This is, Khrushchev, who occupied Stalin's position, and then it breaks down into a series of legislative and administrative entanglements, or sort of branches. Contra what I think a lot of people think, it wasn't just one man. And that will become important later. So now let's look at System A, which was a missile defense network. If I would have done this better, at the end of each of these nodes would have been some little tentacles where remote computers were controlling missile launch sites in these two places. And the other three military networks are sort of similar. There's a master control node
in, we're near Moscow, usually not in Moscow, because that would be a bomb threat. And then successfully, fully automated information computer networks existed. You know, that would obviously stretch thousands of miles. Now let's talk about the design of the economic net itself. As Slava writes, in 1964, Viktor Glushkov, a visionary computer scientist from Kiev, who is well aware of these other military networks, and a guy named Nikolai Fedorenko, a young rising academic, who's 43 at the time, and who is newly appointed the director of the institute that I'm about to talk about, who's in charge for overseeing this project, proposed that they could mathematically optimize the modeling, monitoring, and management of the national economy. And as Slava has detailed, their joint proposal, the 64 proposal, was for a unified system of optimal planning and management based on a three-tier unified nationwide network of computer centers. The proposed network included tens of thousands of local computer centers to collect primary or local information, 30 to 50 mid-level computer centers in major cities, and then one top-level center controlling the entire network and serving the government. That's key. This is serving the entire government, serving the entire network. This was a comprehensive yet decentralized design, right? We're going back to when we're thinking about the network. This is the master plan. You know, Glushkov's proposal was innovative at the time. I mean, we may look at this and be like, oh, you're kidding me, right? This would never work. But it was innovative at the time. He suggested that all economic information be gathered once and only once and stored in one place, which is a vast simplification on the sort of fractured existing procedures in which different planning, defense, and financial ministries would independently process and collect their own data. So what ended up happening, of course, was that almost no middle-level administrators were willing to give up control of their own informational jurisdiction. And you know, this should sound familiar to those of us who live in the modern day. The bureaucratic pyramid, or the decentralization of political power, ensured that people simply did not want to share their own territory because there was, funding or resources were scarce within those artificially constructed decentralized tentacles, administrative and political. Other scholars have argued generally how, at the time, the culture was such not to enjoy sharing, where interpersonal trust networks were very tight, by which I mean, you know, the connections we make with people were few and intense, as opposed to sort of weak and many, which people have stereotyped American culture as. Western critics have also theorized that without personal profit to maximize, socialist administrators tended instead to maximize personal power, and in this case, by refusing to relinquish control over domestic or local flows of information. You know, I'd point out that profit maximizing may lead to unjust or undesirable situations, as the present market situation deems, but at least it does so more efficiently than power maximizing. So this meant the farther you were from defense ministries, basically, the poorer your chances of funding, the farther away the trickle down, lower on the pyramid you were. And in the case of the Central Economic and Mathematical Institute, who was charged with overseeing the economic network, we might note that, first of all, it was brought in from outside. It was brought in from Novosibirsk, from the periphery. It wasn't just created spontaneously in Moscow, but it was brought in became a full-fledged academic institute relocated in Moscow. The institute was founded, and I've looked at the archival networks, they were founded on this vision. They wanted to bring and manage the entire socialist economy. Yet it quickly became clear that the funding was not going to be present. Here's an incident. Once when Fedorenko, the director, the young director of the new institute, approached the Ministry of Defense in 1965 about the possibility of combining their similar computer network programs, an hour of conversation passed, basically them talking to Minister Bagramyan, I'm not quite sure how it is, but the defense minister, and after hearing their case, he replied, You are good men, and you are doing right by concerning yourself with the economy of the people's money, but I cannot help you. Asked, he continued, my friends, the state gives me as much money as I ask for to build the technical basis, which is sort of the slang for the network. As far as I understand, they give you network. They give you nothing. If I were to cooperate with you, they would give money to neither me nor you, since there is the opinion that economics is a scab on the healthy body of the governmental mechanism for planning and management. So this, his final sort of rebuttal that economics itself was not appropriate with the larger socialist vision proved a common one that many Soviet leaders, they became uncomfortable with the idea of algorithm-planned economics. They felt it introduced the idea of automating equilibria, be they, you know, they weren't distinguishing between capitalist free market-driven equilibria and, in their case, an algorithm-driven balancing of inputs and outputs. And they read this as a clear challenge to this Marxian ideal of social justice that the state assumes when it oversees, predicts, and prescribes the economic needs of its people. In fact, Glushkov's original proposal was very visionary. It even thought to get rid of currency altogether. He basically thought that we could do things by electronic payments. Doesn't seem too out of place at the moment. But luckily for him at the time, an advisor instructed him to submit that part separately, and his proposal was approved, but the funding never followed. It was too much, too fast. But it's not entirely fair about the money point. It's slightly disingenuous to describe the failure of the Soviet internet to the lack of funding. In fact, if anything, the Institute, the Mathematical and Economic Institute, suffered from, if anything, a sudden explosion of funding in the early years. By August 1963, the small laboratory from Novosibirsk that had been charged with building the network relocated to Moscow, and it turned its four laboratories with 23 employees. It quickly multiplied into an institute with 700 employees and 40 internal divisions, 16 departments, 30 labs, and eventually a computer center shared with the other academics in Moscow. And the institute did not get its own computer until later in the 1960s. The same year it occupied a giant building, a 22-story building built for it. But at the beginning, when the sort of visionary moment was about, the average age of the faculty was 26. 10 years later, the institute reached 1,000 employees in 1973, and the average age was still a youthful 34. Throughout, we need to remember that most of the staff was intellectually flexible. They were ready for new ideas, and sometimes to the detriment, because even when the original ones that were passed over. And as personal correspondence has confirmed, the institute during these years was a lively and energetic place, full of critically aligned, hopeful young economists and scholars. The workplace spirit was creative and collaborative and enthusiastic and ultimately short-sighted. In 10 years, it had grown 40 times the size of the original laboratory, and most of that growth took place in the first few years. And as some digging has proved, by 1964 and certainly by 1966, it was founded in 63, the vision was articulated in 62, but by 66, the gears had totally shifted, and there was no evidence of anyone self-consciously thinking about building a computer network. Instead, they're concerned about theoretical mathematical modeling of the economy. So they were going to provide the software, in a sense, and nobody was concerned about the design. So there's an irony here about sudden funding. For not only can its absence make projects impossible, but its presence can also distract. And what began as a technical problem in need of funding, a network, became an ideologically driven solution, a programmed, and again not planned, socialist economy. In a sense, the channeling of funding through specific politically shaped ministries and institutes assured that the network project to bridge them would forever be overlooked. So in conclusion, why did the network fail? As Slava points out, like the US and the UK, the Soviet state envisioned computers as a policy instrument for casting military purposes and projects. However, unlike the US state, which supported only the technologies and left the uses up to new uses to private companies, the Soviet state, led by cyberneticists, insisted on building an organic feedback controlled system by decree from above. And it's this paradox that we're arguing for gradual growth from below, writes Grolich. The Soviet leaders argued against gradual growth from below, since the individual parts of their design system would not function efficiently without a comprehensive nationwide system, and a piecemeal approach would only conserve existing practices. Thus, if we have a nationwide management system, any individual part itself was not viable, again, locally, poorly planned. It was obvious that the whole thing could not be viable itself. What could have been a network ended up a patchwork. So these things, I think, that the power, the information reluctance to share, and the reluctance to share funding, again, I just want to reframe as a question of decentralization. It's something for us to think about, not only in Soviet past, but in the present. So, you know, what if anything, can we learn from these two stories? I would offer maybe two corrections, and I'll sit down. I believe, first, that this corrects at least the vocabulary of, if not something more, the conventional critique of the Soviet Union as a centralized entity. Rather, it should be critiqued as a decentralized entity. We should start thinking about that more actively. Traditional Western specialists, let's talk about strongman theories, political centralization, Russian conservatism, etc. They do not sufficiently recognize that those arguments are only possible assuming that a purely centralized system, state, or society in Russia is impossible. The argument for decentralization to be the baseline assumption about Russia is, if anything, credits the other truism that I've talked about, that it is big. True centralization is a geographic impossibility, and this suggests that the multiple layers of periphery and the decentralized architecture will continue to remain as long as the territory covered by the network is large. To understand its history, we must think of Russia or other entities as overlapping layers of periphery and power. Second correction, I believe this at least suggests reason to suspect something of present-day enthusiasm for decentralized rather than distributed power structures and organizations. We might begin to think of systems at a local level instead, to find the sort of the algorithms with which we can plan things comprehensively locally without the comprehensive vision. We might note that Fedorenko had enjoyed supposedly a success in the micro level of, at the firm level or smaller of his analysis. So the center enjoyed a lot of economic analysis success, but only at the micro level. While he said the number of successes at the macro level, what they were originally charged with, could be counted on one hand. I wonder if that's sort of euphemism for zero. Networks based not on decentralized or decentralized distances and directions, but instead expressed in terms of local action that can be repeated anywhere within the system, may stand, I suggest, to enjoy more success in the world of digital communications. And lastly, I just believe that in the 21st century we have much to think about in terms of our own decentralized world. There are obvious and extreme differences between our own case and that of the Soviet Union, but nonetheless, I believe that wherever we look, we can find useful, although potentially susceptible and valuable, decentralized power structures. Thank you. That's our lot.
Are there questions?
Like the presentation.
Nice.
I especially appreciated the highway map.
Cool.
And the electoral route is a nice surprise too. When it comes to the part, is a missile network that had three nodes, kind of like
right.
The United States started DARPANET was a missile network.
Right.
So when you get to the point of the negotiation between possibly Moscow or the next node down,
you know,
as you said, it was more of a hierarchical structure than, it was sort of somewhere between decentralized. Anyway,
right.
At that point, you have this negotiation between two individuals. And I was wondering why one of them wouldn't feel compelled to act in their own self-interest. Because if it's a missile shield, and they have the same level of seriousness, I wonder why they wouldn't develop or allow some sort of creative solution around the economics problem? Or was the economics problem simply too large? But it gets back to the self-interest, so I'm just curious why.
Yeah. No, this is a very interesting question. So the question is, why was the economic, sort of the lack of funding also an effect on the missile network? Because, I think the structuring of the missile network enjoyed a lot of success, so it was intentionally hierarchical, and the economics attempts were just sort of, I'm suggesting, natural consequence of society at the time. But your question, I think, is interesting. Is that what do we do with personal conflicts of interest that arise at these sort of bottlenecks implicit in a decentralized network or
power structure? Yeah, I'm definitely seeing a parallel, a flip side in the United States. I'm seeing a lot of, I don't know where to put them in your spectrum, pseudo-decentralized. I'm seeing solutions evolving, particularly file sharing applications.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I'm thinking, you know, why are these succeeding and, why has these guys failed?
Yeah, no.
And self-interest, I think, is a huge part of why we're succeeding here.
Good, good. No, there are definitely more variables at hand than the design of the network itself. This is clearly not to say that decentralized networks are bound to fail. Only that they can, and this is a sort of magnificent example of one that can. I don't know. Does anyone have any thoughts on why sometimes conflicts of interest can be resolved through sharing, sometimes it can be resolved through hoarding, and the decentralized network that results is may or may not fail, or if not.
We have someone on the cooperation. I was going to say. There's some interesting research going on at the Bergman Center that's trying to look at different modes of cooperation, but I don't think.
But we would have a question. We would have an answer. We would.
Yeah, let me know.
Invite you to come and talk to present this.
Yeah. Or I mean, game theory clearly is a long-running attempt to figure out sort of the economics or the personal incentives to make decisions one way or the other. Tit for tat. I don't know if you guys know about tit for tat, but that seems to be the most largely one of the more successful theories from game theory is that the best way to get along with the person you're interacting with is to mimic them. If they cooperate, you cooperate. If they push against you, you push against them. That's not necessarily the best way, but it is a seeming way of operating that many people will adopt. So that may raise larger questions about the culture. I mean, was it just a problem of interpersonal networks of trust in the Soviet Union that resulted in this? I don't know. But this is a key question for me. Thank you.
I have a question somewhat about the discourse that surrounded these premises. During the way they themselves, far from that era, describe these networks. How do they relate to this network? Like, what is the vision they see in this network? Like, we know how today in the US people talk about the internet, and the sharing part is part of this discourse. Like, it's part of the way people describe to themselves the way the network was constructed.
Right.
And what you read about, way people write about it.
Yeah, what were they talking about? Slava, please chime in here, but I think the way I'd answer that is to tend that most of the concerns were pragmatic or sort of administrative rather than visionary. I mean, maybe Glushkov and his vision of orchestrating a massive national economy is something idealistic. But for the large part, much like the US, ARPANET, in fact, you know, some of the key decisions about making it distributed, making the ARPANET distributed instead of something else, was a practical decision. It was a practical solution to a real life problem imposed upon, in this case, Paul Baran by the Defense Department. So, if you're interested, why is the ARPANET distributed? There's good stories we can tell now, but he writes, at least he recalls, that he came up with the idea of packet switching simply as the best solution to the problem of survivability. Survivability was mandated for them. They were just like, look, you need this network to survive. Doesn't have to be robust. Robustness and not survivability weren't the same thing. The Defense Department was like, the network needs to survive a missile attack. That's because all we need to do is send the go code to relaunch missiles. So, I mean, in that political sense, you know, it's actually not very comforting that the original inspiration for distribution comes out of, you know, the hope of being able to retaliate. But nonetheless, I think the practical concerns of the network builders were that kind of stuff. It was institutions asking people to write grants and get projects done that sort of sparked some of these original inspirations.
Necessity is a mother of invention.
Sorry?
Necessity is a mother of invention.
Yeah.
I'm not totally up on Soviet history, but my understanding is, I remember correctly, that they, at some points, they did try and, like, import supercomputers from the West to run the economy, come up with super ministries and stuff to get around this stuff. I remember hearing that sort of a story I heard in terms of the later part of the Soviet Union. Did that have any real impact, or they sort of, seems like they were sort of then trying to do what was proposed in the 60s, at least at a high level?
I don't know that period as well. I know that a lot of the hardware gap was made up by bringing in Western computers. I don't think it ever succeeded, any sort of master plan of economic information harvesting management at the meta ministry level. There is, I think it's called Rosstat today, which is an information gathering service in the present Russian Federation that uses sort of online information harvesting tools to manage a lot of things. And it also is perhaps unsurprisingly closed. Sociologists don't have access to see what is published or what isn't published.
Right.
Is this question, sorry.
Is it sort of still like the, even if you get a super ministry, the lower level ministers don't cooperate with it? They don't have, super ministers didn't have the power, or?
Yeah, I don't know. I assume so.
Perhaps, partly answer your question. They were not able to manage the entire economy through any kind of computing means. As you know, there were five-year plans for the economy, and they would compute the five-year plan by the end of the first year of the five-year period. So the first year, everybody would operate without a real plan. And then by the time they computed, the economic situation, which was the plan was supposed to reflect and project, had already changed. So they were just keeping up with developments rather than effectively planning it.
If you guys have any questions, please feel free to email me, pjpeters@gmail.com. And thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.